Live from Southern California, this is the Jim Rome Show.
All right, so starting right here in the obvious spot, over the past few months, there have been a lot of reports about Tom Brady. Tom Brady is thinking this, according to sources. Tom Brady is thinking that, according to reports. Well, here's one for you. Tom Brady is done with the Patriots, according to Tom Brady. He released a statement in two Instagram posts this morning. There was one that was addressed to the Patriots fans, and it included the following, quote, "I want to say thank you to all the incredible fans and Patriots supporters. MA has been my home for 20 years. It truly has been the happiest two decades of my life. I have nothing but love and gratitude for my time in New England. The support has been overwhelming. I wish every player could experience it," or player. "I thank you from the bottom of my heart. I will always love you and what we have shared, a lifetime full of memories," end quote. And then there is one which includes the money quote. "Although my football journey will take place elsewhere, I appreciate everything that we have achieved, and I'm grateful for our incredible team accomplishments. I have been privileged to have had the opportunity to know each and every one of you and to have the memories we have created together," end quote. There you have it. Just like that, Tom Brady's run in New England is over. And you know what? What a run it's been. 20 seasons, 6 rings, 4 Super Bowl MVP awards, 3 league MVP awards, 15 Super Bowl records. Cry. Now is not a time to cry. Now is the time to laugh. 9 conference championships, 17 divisional titles. The list goes on. Thanks, Alvin. It's just because he's done his best to turn this entire thing into the most tedious thing ever with some corny TV commercials and desperate pub grabs does not mean that it's not a really significant moment, because it is. The greatest coach quarterback combo in NFL history is finished. Brady and Belichick. Belichick and Brady is no more. And that is a bucket of ice cold water for Pats fans on St. Paddy's Day when the bars in Boston are closed. And if it hadn't been for all that contrived drama and all Brady's desperate beneath him attempts to get us to look at him and talk about him and rip leverage, Brady's announcement would have come off as shocking, but a classy departure. But that's not the way it feels. No, it feels more personal, and not in a good way. Personal like he wanted to leave. Personal like he wanted to leave because he got sick of Bill Belichick. And if in fact that's the case, I can't blame that guy at all. If Belichick didn't once say in 20 years,
Tommy, you're my guy.
If he didn't say once in 20 years, you're my guy, it probably was more a case of him just being a guy, just one of 53.
No one is bigger than the team.
If I were Brady and I did what I did in that uniform, in that town, in that facility, in that organization, on that field, I'd be pissed too. Given what he has given to that organization, given to, yes, what he has given to the hood, that would anger me as well if Belichick never gave him any of that love and treated him like one of the other 52. And for all you chouds who are waiting for Bob Kraft to come in at the last second and make sure that this very thing didn't happen, here is what he told ESPN. Kraft said, quote, "Tommy initiated contact last night and came over. We had a positive, respectful discussion. It's not the way I want it to end, but I want him to do what is in his best personal interest. After 20 years with us, he has earned that right. I love him like a son," end quote. Let me translate that for you. Translation: Brady is like a son to me, and I love him as much as I do my own sons. I just like his dad, the hood, better. So I'm picking the coach over the QB. And one more thing. Why are we still calling a 42-year-old man Tommy? Tommy initiated contact last night. Why are we calling a 42-year-old man Tommy? Yeah, put that aside for a minute. Because what's even more interesting than what Bobby and Billy and Tommy call each other are some of the details from Tom Curran, who we know is plugged in. Kraft told Curran, quote, "This is not the way I wanted it to end. But in life, people need to be free to realize what's important to them. I respect him so much. It was a sad, loving discussion." End quote. Yeah, it's a little weird. Because it seems like the owner of the team is saying he didn't have the agency or the power or the authority in the situation. He also seemed to be saying that he was surprised. Kraft said, quote, "I thought he was coming over, as he has for the last 10 years, to quietly get things done," end quote. And then Curran asked Kraft if he was disappointed that the negotiations did not get deeper. Quote, "It's not about that. This is a big picture. I just don't think he was going to be happy staying in our system at this point," end quote. Seems to me there's a lot to parse in those statements. Like, what you're not hearing is, we made him a great offer, and he just thought it was time to move on. Let me put it to you another way. Curran tweeted this morning, quote, "In the end, a tangible effort by the Patriots to keep Tom Brady in New England never happened. No negotiation, just the intimation that it was on Brady to say what he wanted. For Brady, that stance spoke volumes," end quote. If that's the way that went down, that's not a surprise at all. Not a surprise that the Patriots handled it that way. Not a surprise that Brady left if they handled it that way. If after 20 years and all that hardware and all the stacks and stacks of cash, Bill Belichick's attitude was still, "You can stay or you can go," hell, I'd go too. Of course TB43 bounced. Then again, if TB43 was looking for some level of respect or sentimentality, he's looking in the wrong place. It doesn't mean that he should stick around when he doesn't get it. He's done more than enough to dictate terms and get himself a fat contract and a golden handshake at the end of his career. Plenty of other less accomplished guys have received a lot more than that. But that's not how the hood rolls. And you sure get the sense that Belichick was looking for the ultimate way to prove that he's the ultimate guy when it comes to making cold business decisions. One thing to break off guys like Richard Seymour and Lawyer Malloy. Quite another to tell Tom Brady, the most beloved and respected player in Patriots history, hit the bricks, which is exactly what the hood did. And no, that doesn't make him an awesome coach or an awesome leader. And even if Brady will be 43 this season and isn't what he once was, this is still a big gamble for Belichick and Kraft and the organization. So, end of the day, why is Belichick doing the alleged GOAT the way he is? One, because Belichick does everybody like that. Two, for the same reason he does anything. And no, not because he can, but because it's, quote, for the good of the team. That's why Belichick does everything for the good of the team. And number three, don't tell me this is not part of it, but he wants to prove that the Hall of Fame coach was a bigger part of the equation than the Hall of Fame quarterback. That the GOAT coach is more valuable than the GOAT QB. And that the QB needs him more than he needs the QB. Don't tell me that's got nothing to do with it, because it does. And don't tell me it's not the same way for Brady, because it is. Hell yes, TB43 wants to prove that he had more to do with the success of the Pats than Belichick. Hell yes, Brady wants to prove that the hood needed him more than he needed the hood. And I'm fine with it. Just know, like Belichick, Brady is taking a big swing here. It's a big gamble wherever he goes, be it LA or Tampa or otherwise, because the best fit and the safest play would have been to stay right where he was. And I respect that he's not doing that. I respect that Brady is taking his shot. No matter how wack he looks in that Tampa Bay Buccaneer uniform. Wherever he ends up. Bottom line for me, I respect the hell out of his decision. This is not the easy way out. This is not the path of less resistance. I respect the hell out of the decision. I just think the way he went about it was corny as hell and way beneath the alleged GOAT. Hey, clones, the question of the day. What do we want when we're craving protein or we need more energy? I can tell you what we don't want. We don't want another bar or another sugary snack or another energy drink. No, instead we want beef. Pure and simple. So where's the beef? It's in a package of Old Trapper beef jerky. Old Trapper is not your old man's jerky. It's not shriveled. It's not dry. It's not tasteless. Old Trapper beef jerky is made from lean strips of steak and quality spices that are smoked over a real wood fire. So it's tender and tasty. It's not tough. What makes it so good? I'm going to say it's the company behind it. Old Trapper is a 50-year-old family business known for their relentless commitment to quality. And Old Trapper is packed with protein. It comes in four amazing flavors to satisfy all your cravings. It's quality smoked meat at its finest, and it goes wherever you go. Look for Old Trapper in the Clearview bag. That way you can see the quality you're purchasing. Look for it in major retail stores near you. If you don't see it, be sure to ask for it by name, because no other jerky compares. Old Trapper, what's your beef? Lorenzo Alexander is my guest. Lorenzo, great to have you back. How are you?
I'm doing great, Jim. How you been?
Good, good. All right, so as always, there's a lot to talk about with you. Lorenzo, initially I wanted to talk with you about the CBA, but then so much has happened in the last 24 hours involving your old team, the Bills, and the AFC East. So let me start there. Tom Brady did announce on Instagram that he's leaving New England. What was your reaction, Lorenzo, when you heard that?
I don't know if I was surprised. I mean, I think that's kind of been the narrative ever since the end of the season occurred, and you started hearing riffs, and obviously seeing him and Edelman kind of on ESPN and him saying that he's going to leave and talking to other teams. And so, at some point, you know, all great things end. I even think about growing up in the Bay Area about a guy, Joe Montana, you know, being one of the best ever too. And he ends up finishing his career on the Kansas City Chiefs. And so it's always possible, you know, in the NFL. And so I know everybody in the Bills Mafia is standing up and clapping and glad that the Tom Brady era is over as far as the NFC East is concerned.
No doubt. I'm going to get to the Bills Mafia in 1 minute. Lorenzo Alexander, my guest. What kind of memories do you have of going up against Brady? What was that like?
I enjoyed every minute of it. I think you play this game obviously to be on the highest level, but even more importantly, to play the best and to be able to have the opportunity to play in an era where you are playing essentially the greatest quarterback of all time. I loved it. You know, I don't think I might have beat his team once, but I don't think he played. But just being able to compete against him, going out there, you know, having the opportunity to sack him, intercept him, all those things that I can share those type of memories with my kids and my grandkids as they get older because, you know, obviously that's iconic and everybody doesn't have that opportunity. But the dude is a monster. I guess his greatest attribute, the thing that I appreciate the most, was his selflessness and whatever it took to win a game he was going to do. And if that meant handing the ball off 40 times, which he did, I think, again, was 1 year with Sony Michel, and one, he was going to do that and sacrifice his own personal stats because he was all about wins and championships.
Those two things that are really key right there. He was selfless, and, quote, that dude was a monster. Lorenzo Alexander joining us. I love it. So what about the Bills? They have reportedly agreed to terms with defensive end Mario Addison. You tweeted that you've been a fan of his for a long time. What do you like about him and his game?
I just love the versatility. He's able to stand up, obviously come off the edge. He can play the choker role that we have in our third down package where you have essentially three down linemen and he stands up. I think he'll work well with the rotation of guys, Trent Murphy and Jerry Hughes at defensive end. And then you can also slide him inside, so he's versatile in that manner. And I had some time to spend with him when I was in Washington earlier in his career and just was really cool to know him, the type of character guy he is. I know Sean puts a high emphasis on having leadership, and he's definitely going to be able to fill that role wholeheartedly, not only in the defensive line room, but just throughout the team, to really be able to help young guys mature, guys like Mike Love, who's another young defensive lineman on the Bills roster.
Lorenzo Alexander joining us, talking about his former team. Now, the team also reportedly agreed to a trade that's going to bring Stephon Diggs over from Minnesota. How do you like that fit for the offense?
I love it. Obviously, Stephon is another guy that's had a lot of success in this league, and you're just adding more weapons to allow Josh Allen to be successful. Obviously, in a time where we're not quite sure what the offseason is going to hold with the whole coronavirus, when you add a veteran like that, I think it only helps him because now he has another safety net. It's a veteran that the learning curve isn't as great with maybe drafting a young guy and a rookie who doesn't have an offseason to prepare. So it's going to help him in a lot of ways to be more successful. And then just the way Stephon plays, just getting open. His separation window is really going to allow Josh not to have to be, you know, 100% accurate, but be able to put the ball on him and make a lot of great plays in that manner as well.
I couldn't agree with you more. I love that move. I love that move. I know they gave up a lot to get him, but I love that move. And so when you see that move and you see what the Bills did last year, and now you see additions, and then you include a guy like Josh Norman, what kind of thoughts do you have about the team going forward?
I think Brandon's done a great job of trying to fill some holes and some gaps, and not only that, but also make the team much better. We also signed back a guard, Quentin Spain, which I thought was huge for the offensive line. And so they're putting themselves in a position of where their offense will be much more explosive this year. And if we come back, or you know, the Bills come back, I'm still getting a hard time transitioning. If the Bills come back next year defensively and kind of just take another step defensively and create some more turnovers, the Bills organization is going to be happy with the production that they have next year as a team as far as getting into the playoffs and really making a true run at winning the Lombardi Trophy.
Yeah, I feel you. That transition's got to be tough. When you were in it as long as you were and you loved it the way you loved it and you paid that price. Like, I know when you retired, it was about spending more time with your family, and I know that's the most important thing. But right. Lorenzo, now that you're a few months into it and you see all these moves being made, is there any small part of you, even a small part of you, that gets the itch to want to return?
Not really, but if, you know, Brandon Bean or Steve Kine call me and say, hey, Zoe, we need you back, we'll give you one for six, one for seven, I don't know. I may get up, but right now I'm enjoying time. I mean, obviously, with the whole world the way it is, I'm really getting a full cup of water with having kids at home and be able to spend time, and so I'm really enjoying this time, you know, just kind of hanging out, working out, and living life, and at this time, I really don't have an inkling to really return, but you just never know what the future may hold if the right opportunity proposes itself and my wife's okay with it.
Never say never, and if the wife's okay with it, maybe. Lorenzo Alexander joining us for a few more moments. Now, I did mention off the top that you are a member of the NFLPA Executive Committee. From the outside, Lorenzo, that would seem like a pretty thankless job. Why is that something that you want to commit to and was important to you?
Because I think it's important that we have great leadership, and I sit on the committee that we have a lot of guys that I respect around the league of, you know, various backgrounds as far as diversity of being first rounders, undrafted guys like myself and young and old. And in order for us to continue to make strides, when we talk about making movements for the CBA, player health and safety, share the money, all those things, we have to continue to have those type of men in membership and wanting to be involved. And so it's just a great way for me to encourage people in my own locker room and other guys around the league to get more involved, as well as help push the betterment of our player membership forward as well as our former players as well.
You know, it seems to me that one of the big challenges would be you're representing a large and diverse group of players who are at different points in their careers. Yep. There's going to be a lot of different needs, wants, and concerns from different groups of players. How do you go about trying to work with that and represent everybody?
Yeah, that's always the hard thing, right? Because you have guys, as you mentioned, that have a very diverse background. From first round, the deal is not going to affect them the same way as an undrafted guy or a guy that's 10 years in the league versus a rookie. And that's not even to mention our former players who also have their own desires as far as how we can best help them with benefits that we already have in place. And so the only way we can really truly do it is make sure that everybody's voice is heard. And over the last really 2 years, maybe even longer than that, we've just really been gathering ideas from guys, former and current players, of what's the best way we could move forward. We put a proposal together that we share with the league. And, you know, anytime in negotiations, you have everything that you want, but you're not able to accomplish everything or achieve every goal that you set out to get. But I do believe when you sit back and look at this thing from a bird's eye view, we did impact a significant amount of players, much more than I think people believe we did in a positive manner. But like I said, with any deal, there's always people that get lost, like with the TNP issue, which I'm sure you've seen on Twitter as well, where I think we failed both the league and us, and that hopefully we can make an amendment to that. And then also, you know, the tags and guaranteed money and things of that nature that we talk about control and finances that we probably didn't go as far or even move far enough for a certain group of guys in our membership.
Appreciate your thoughts on that. Before I let you go, one last thing. What about your reaction to the idea of a 17th regular season game? Where do you come out on that?
Yeah, for me, you know, obviously – I wouldn't want to play one, but I played 15 years. And so I try to, you know, kind of put myself away from it and ask other people around the league how they felt about it. You know, and this is coming from an EC member. When I voted no because of that. I wouldn't want to subject myself to that. But there's a lot of young guys, including myself, when I was trying to get in, that would be willing to play a 17th game, you know, understanding the impact. And from the way I look at it, with the minimums and the increase, you could maybe leave this game a lot earlier. And for my own self, if I had the type of minimums that a lot of these guys would be able to benefit from, I may not have to play the last, you know, 2-3 years of my career, which is essentially 32-plus games, in order to reach financial freedom and not have to work but choose to work. And so there is a trade-off, but if you're one of those guys that are able to maximize it early in your career, maybe you decide, okay, I'm good after 8. I got my benefits. My finances are in good order, and I can walk away this game, and I don't have to play an additional 2 or 3 years, which is essentially, you know, more games, 34 games potentially on your body if you have to play 2 additional seasons.
As weird as it is to see Tom Brady in somebody else's uniform next year, after seeing him in a patch uniform for 20 years, that's still not nearly as weird as O'Brien trading DeAndre Hopkins. Correction. Not just trading him, but getting worked in that trade. Bad trade? Bad trade. I'm not sure I've ever seen a worse trade. And O'Brien looks even dumber today than he did yesterday, if that's even possible. Then again, we are talking about the guy who wanted to trade Jadeveon Clowney last year and ended up butchering that deal so badly that he ended up dealing him while having to still pay half his salary while he played for the Seahawks. Not only did he have the hammer in that deal, he handed it right to Seattle and then let Seattle beat him over the head with it. Then he chased that by giving up 2 first-round picks to get Laremy Tunsil, except he didn't agree to an extension with Tunsil before they made that deal, giving Tunsil a ton of leverage when it comes to an extension. And that's just what he's doing as a GM. You know, it'd be one thing to say, well, he's in over his head as a GM, or both those jobs are too much for any one person to handle. But man, he's a damn good coach. Except nobody's saying that. I mean, that's what he did as a GM, but the coaching job has not been much better. Remember, the Texans had a 24-0 lead over Kansas City in the playoffs. Remember that? And they found a way to blow it, which was amazing. So this dude, incredibly, has 2 jobs, and he's really not good at either one of them at this point. You want to know a great way to make people forget about blowing a 24-0 lead in the playoffs? Because they're never going to forget that. They will never let you forget that. So what do? The best way to make people forget about blowing a 24-0 lead in the playoffs is to trade away your best weapon in the offseason. Not only trade away your best weapon in the offseason, but trade away your best weapon in the offseason and get next to nothing in return. Let me just recap this. According to reports, the trade is as follows. Houston trades DeAndre Hopkins to Arizona for David Johnson, a 2nd-round pick this year, and a 4th-round pick next year, which is brutal. And it's still not even right because it's actually DeAndre Hopkins and a 4th-round pick for David Johnson, a 2nd and a 4th, according to reports. And I say according to reports because I still can't believe that's real. I can't believe that that's a thing because that's how terrible that trade is. All that trade was missing was a, hey, y'all, watch this.
Hey, y'all, watch this.
Before O'Brien signed off on it. I mean, is that a trade deal? Or a jackass stunt? My name is Bill O'Brien, and this is me blowing up my team and wrecking my generational quarterback's life. Literally. I mean, why not just go to that hardware store and drag that toilet out to the parking lot that's not hooked up to anything and just take a dump on it? I mean, that's what that deal is. There's so many different ways to look at this trade. But why don't we start with the fact that David Johnson did have an amazing season. He did. One of the best seasons in league history. In 2016, that's a long time ago, And it was clear that things were not working out in Arizona last year. And he's got an oversized contract. So just getting rid of this guy, or what's left of this guy, and his bloated contract would have been a huge win for Arizona. But to not only do that, but to turn him into DeAndre Hopkins is mind-blowing. I mean, I can't even believe that that happened. Like, didn't the commissioner step in and block that deal? Would anybody have even had an issue if Roger Goodell stepped in and said, oh no, I'm not doing that. You know, kind of like my guy David Stern blocking Chris Paul to the Lakers. No, that's not fair. Oh no, we're not doing that. That's not in the best interest of the league. That wouldn't have surprised me at all. That's how whack that trade is. When O'Brien agreed to that deal, the Cards must have been like, are you freaking kidding me? You will. Okay. I can't get my head around it. They just moved David Johnson and David Johnson's contract. And in return, they got an all-pro receiver. They received a guy who is tied for the second most receptions in the first seven seasons of his NFL career. A bona fide stud.
Bona fide.
And by the same token, Houston just traded a guy who has dealt with serious injuries in the last three seasons, and they dumped a player who has just missed two games in his career. They traded for a guy with serious injuries. And they dumped a guy who had missed just two games in his career, and one of those games was when Houston was resting its starters. And then from a contractual standpoint, their cap hits are effectively the same. And then how about the Stones? This makes me laugh. How about the Stones of the Cardinals to not only make that trade, but that it wasn't enough? Like, not only are they getting rid of this guy and this contract and getting an incredible receiver, that wasn't enough. They had to make sure they got a fourth round pick as well. Man, that's brass. That is really brass. That's just running up the score at that point. Brass as hell on their part and dumb as hell on O'Brien's part. So again, I ask you, the hell is Bill O'Brien doing? You know what? Was it personal? It sure seems like it was personal. And it is kind of an open secret that O'Brien and Hopkins did not see eye to eye. And if that's what this is, and if that trade was made because it was personal, I'm here to tell you, Bill O'Brien is not a good enough coach to make it personal. Not with a guy like DeAndre Hopkins. Not with a talent like that. If Bill Belichick doesn't want to re-sign Tom Brady, or he wants to trade a guy because he doesn't like him, Belichick gets the benefit of the doubt. He does have six rings. All O'Brien has is a line on his resume which says that he worked for Bill Belichick. And we all know that means next to nothing. Unless your name is Scott Pioli. And here's the other hideous part of this trade from a Houston perspective. It's the Deshaun Watson side of things. Hideous and disgraceful. I mean, it really is disgraceful. I've said it before and I'll say it again here. When you have an elite, transcendent, talented quarterback, you do whatever you can to surround that transcendent talent at quarterback. You do whatever you can to surround him with talent and to win. This is what Kansas City has done with Patrick Mahomes. This is what Baltimore has done with Lamar Jackson. This is what Arizona is doing with Kyler. But not Houston. Oh, no, not Houston. Houston's going the other way. Houston seems determined to make life as hard and as miserable for Deshaun Watson as possible. They've got a Ferrari, but they're determined to strip it down and sell it for parts, which is brutal. You've got a responsibility to your quarterback to make sure he's protected and safe in the pocket and that he has weapons to throw to, which means you do not trade away the best weapon you have. And if you do, if for some reason you absolutely have to trade your best weapon, you make sure you get great value in return, which is exactly what Houston did not do. Don't take my word for it. Listen to people around the league. Take a look at NFL Twitter, which is what we'll do when we come back. I can't believe they made that deal. Of the Move the Sticks podcast, along with Bucky Brooks, he is Daniel Jeremiah. DJ, how you holding up? How are you?
I'm doing good, buddy. We've got We've got all four kids home, so they're doing school basically through the computer with everything set up right now. But everybody's doing good, man. We're, you know, it's a different time, but it's been fun having some football to talk about the last couple of days, that's for sure.
Boy, I agree with that. DJ, Daniel Jeremiah, my guest. I've got two kids, one home from college and one in high school who was starting school on the computer as well. So I kind of know where you're going with that. Listen, in a normal year, from a front office perspective, in a normal year, what are the days like leading up to the official start of free agency for a team?
It's busy. I would say the majority of the planning kind of takes place at the combine. So you're kind of getting all that stuff set up of, you know, what, get a gauge, a little bit of what the market looks like, the guys you're going to be in on, making sure they know that you're calling, that you're going to be involved in the discussion. So it's not like there's this huge ramping up, you know, 1-2 days before. I would say that all kind of takes place there in Indianapolis to kind of lay the groundwork there of what you want to get accomplished. And then it just comes down to, okay, you know, we've got so many people in our personnel department here. It's divide and conquer. If you're working on these guys, you know, I'm working on those guys, and divide up those duties. And then it's a lot of, you know, plan A, B, and C, and being able to adjust in a quick fashion.
He is an NFL Network analyst, Daniel Jeremiah, my guest. You know, I also want to get into how COVID-19 impacts the draft process in a minute, but what kind of an impact does it have on free agency when you're not able to bring potential free agents to your facility to meet with them, show them around, and talk with them face-to-face?
Well, I think that's changed over the last handful of years. It used to be, you know, guys would go on their free agent tours, man. You know, they travel around, visit four teams, and then try and decide, you know, at home with their family what the best decision is. And then it just became a free-for-all, which once this thing opened, the money started flying and deals got done, you know, without those visits. Now, there's usually guys, kind of more the down-the-road guys, you might want to bring in and visit with them. But these top-tier guys, they fly off the board without the visits. Now, nothing's legit on these deals signed in place until you get a physical. So that's true for everybody. And we've seen, I think it was, what was it, last year, right, with Anthony Barr, who had agreed during this period of time with the Jets and then changed his mind, ended up going back to the Vikings once got a chance to actually put pen to paper. So nothing's really official at this point in time, but I think all this stuff is agreed to, and I would anticipate it'll all go through.
We're talking to Daniel Jeremiah. All right, so where does that leave Tom Brady? You know, the argument also, and I'm hearing what you're saying, but some would try to make the argument that if he was not going to be in New England with that offense and a system that has been developed by him and around him, that leaving to go to a new team and a new system might be tricky. Is it, in his case, going to be trickier if he can't physically go into that facility and begin doing what he needs to do?
Oh, I think it definitely is a great point. And it's not even getting a chance to get in there and learn and be around your coaches and be in off-season programs, but really, you know, getting a chance to know your receivers and know who you've got, get on the same page timing wise. Now, I mean, that's going to be a tall order and a tough task if we have, you know, if the off season just gets away from us and these guys are just reporting for training camp after we get through all the stuff we're going on right now with the virus. So yeah, that's going to be a big challenge, not just for Tom Brady, for any of these quarterbacks changing places. Think about Teddy Bridgewater even going to Carolina. Obviously he has a relationship with Joe Brady, but it's different when you get a chance to get out there on the field with your guys and practice and getting a rhythm and getting a flow with those guys. That's going to be a huge opportunity lost with what we're dealing with around the world right now.
Daniel Jeremiah, NFL Network analyst, is joining us. You can follow him on Twitter at Move the Sticks. I was going to ask you about that fit. You touched on it. So let me just quickly move to DeAndre Hopkins. TJ, what was your reaction to Arizona getting DeAndre Hopkins?
Dude, multifaceted reaction. I would say, to be honest with you, the first one was, why did Houston not get more? You know, that's the first reaction I think everybody had around the league. And my phone blew up from buddies just like, they didn't get a one for Hopkins. That was the first shocking point. The second point is, I'm so fired up for Kyler Murray to see what that dude's going to do. He's got a chance to really, really be a superstar in this league. And when you have Hopkins and Christian Kirk and you get another year with Fitz, this offense last year, they couldn't really run it the way that Kingsbury wanted to run it because they couldn't protect. So they had to keep guys in. And when you keep guys in, not only do you limit the options you have in the passing game, now you've really clouded the vision for your undersized quarterback who's ultra athletic. There's nowhere really for him to go. I think he rushed like 500 yards last year, Jim. you're going to see him rush for close to 1,000 yards this year because they're going to be able to use the eighth pick on an offensive lineman. They're going to get better up front. They're going to get all these guys out into the route. You've got to respect the weapons they have, and there's going to be space. And once this dude sees space, he can get it in a hurry.
It is amazing. I can't believe it on any level, and it is a brilliant, brilliant thing for Arizona. Daniel Jeremiah joining us for all the reasons you mentioned. What about the Colts? They trade the first-round pick to San Francisco for DeForest Buckner. What's that trade tell you about the Colts' philosophy and what they'll probably be doing at quarterback then in free agency?
I think it ties in. I mean, it's kind of a we're going in right now. We're ready to win right now. Buckner is a stud, man. He is really good. And I think Mike Lombardi might even have tweeted out right after it happened, which was a great point, that, you know, if you're in the AFC right now, you're building your team with one thing in mind, and that's being able to compete against Patrick Mahomes and the Kansas City Chiefs. And to be able to get interior pressure like Buckner can do, that's the best way to disrupt a big-time passing attack. And, you know, I think it's a right now move, which points to Phillip Rivers. I said yesterday, I'd be shocked if that doesn't get done. You know, maybe they come out of left field. Who knows? Maybe they get it on Tom Brady, but I got to believe that, you know, they're going to get something done with a veteran, and Phillip Rivers seems like the smart one to try and go make a push here over the next 2 years.
We're talking to Daniel Jeremiah for a few more moments. I thought you had a great tweet yesterday when you said, quote, text from personnel exec, no surprise to see all the smart teams loading up on DL, end of tweet. So when you look at the way the game is played right now, why is defensive line where the smart teams are looking?
Well, I just think that's the best way to win football games right now in 2020 is with great quarterback play, great D-line play. And even with the Chiefs last year, we can talk about Mahomes and what he did and just, you know, he's a rare special player. But that game, Jim, doesn't go their way if you don't get Chris Jones and Frank Clark making big-time impact plays. Obviously, the team they played, the 49ers, their defensive front carried them almost to a title. So that's going to be there each and every year. If you've got a great defensive line, you've got great quarterback play, it's tough to not be a winning team. I mean, that's the formula. That's how it works. So when you see the Baltimore Ravens loading up on defensive linemen, when you see the Philadelphia Eagles who already have Fletcher Cox and Brandon Graham, and they go out and get a Javon Hargrave, there's a reason why teams like that are in the postseason every year. There's a reason why Chris Ballard is viewed as one of the top young GMs in the NFL. He goes out and trades for Buckner. These guys, they get it, man. That's how you win games.
So, DJ, what about the Titans? What do you make of the decisions that they made as it relates to Ryan Tannehill and Derrick Henry? Do you like that?
Yeah, I do. You know, look, they go on the road. They beat Baltimore. Obviously, they beat New England in the postseason. They're winning in the AFC Championship game to go to the Super Bowl. It's not an easy way to play. But that's their formula, and that's how it works. And I think they're committed to that. And I think you might have a little bit of a lower ceiling with the way they're going about business. I think you have a very, very high floor, and I think if you catch everything right, I think you could win a championship with Ryan Tannehill because he's going to protect the football. He's got the ability to make three or four plays with his arm or with his legs that you need. It's always going to be – They're not going to be playing a lot of, you know, 20-point spread games on either side. They're going to be in every game. That can be both a good thing and a bad thing.
He is an NFL Network analyst. You can follow him on Twitter at Move the Sticks. Remember, Daniel Jeremiah is host of the Move the Sticks podcast along with Bucky Brooks. DJ, I know it's a busy time. Really good to have you back. I appreciate it very, very much. Great to talk to you.
Well, it's great to catch up, Jim. You're my guy. Always will be.
Buffalo, how is your day going? Do you just want to start planning that parade route right now? I mean, look at it from Buffalo's standpoint. In a matter of hours, the Bills make a deal for Stephon Diggs. And then they watch Tom Brady leave the AFC East. What a massive day for Buffalo. The details of the trade are this. Buffalo sends a first, a fifth, a sixth, and next year's fourth to Minnesota for Stephon Diggs and a seventh round pick. It raises the question again, what the hell is Bill O'Brien doing? If you thought the Texans trading DeAndre Hopkins looked bad before, it is revolting now. Minnesota, again, got a first, a fourth, a fifth, and a sixth for Stephon Diggs. Houston got David Johnson and a second. Uh-oh! It's like Texan fan was already crumpled up in the fetal position, and then somebody came by and kicked him in the junk again. You believe that? Minnesota got a first, a fourth, a fifth, and a sixth for the Stephon Diggs. Houston got David Johnson and a second. Now, that's a big swing for Buffalo. It makes their receiving core that much better. It'll make Josh Allen, who took a big step last year, that much better. John Brown and Cole Beasley can slide over. Diggs becomes the primary target. The offense improves dramatically. In fact, that offense has got the potential now to be downright scary. I love that move for Buffalo. I love it. You give Josh Allen those weapons. And again, this is what you do for a young quarterback. You surround him with as many weapons as you possibly can. Buffalo understands that. Kansas City understands that. Baltimore understands that. Houston does not. Give Josh Allen those weapons. You couple that with the way he's grown as a quarterback and the respect that the guys in the locker room already have for him, and a defense, which is very good. And now the Bills Mafia has got a lot to be excited about. Even more than what the trade does for Buffalo, it says, or I like what it says about Buffalo. It says, we're going for it. It says that being a good story is not good enough. It says that breaking the playoff drought was all right, but we're about much more than that. Those days are over. The bar has been raised. Like, they're not sitting around waiting to see whether or not they get lucky with a wideout in the draft. They didn't even wait to see what was going to happen with Tom Brady before they made that move. They were going full on. They were going all in, regardless of what Brady did or did not do. Maybe they knew. Maybe they had an inkling. Or maybe they didn't. It didn't matter. It wasn't about what Brady was going to do. It was about what they were going to do. They were looking to dictate the situation. And the message it sends is, we're not just happy making the playoffs. We want to get there and we want to make some noise. They don't just want to win the wild card. They want to win the AFC East. They don't just want to win the AFC East. They want to win the conference. They're not here to take part. They're here to take over. I'm not saying it makes them a team to beat necessarily in the AFC. I'm saying they're in the equation. And they look a hell of a lot better right now than they did 24 hours ago. And then you do chase that trade with the departure of Tom Brady. That's got to be a reason to slam a table or five at your house, Bills Mafia, if you're self-isolating. And you should be. Again, I love it. They've got their franchise quarterback. They now have a legitimate number one receiver. Yes, they gave up a lot to get him. Yes, he's not always the easiest guy to be around. How many star receivers are, though? In fact, I don't really care about any of that. Diggs may not have been happy in Minnesota. He might not have been happy with the quarterback he had in Minnesota. But it says here, this guy's going to love Buffalo. He'll love Buffalo once he gets around Josh Allen, because all those guys love Josh Allen. He's going to love Buffalo once he gets around the Bills Mafia and he finds out how much they love him, because they love great players. I think that's a great move by the Bills. Yeah, sure, there's some risk. Yes, they paid a premium, but I think it's worth it. I love that move. Great move for that offense. And he was not the only receiver making news yesterday. There was also Randall Cobb signing with the Texans. I guess, to partially, sort of, kind of, not really make up for the departure of Hopkins. It's not even fair to Cobb to make that comparison. There are different receivers who do different things. Again, there's nothing you can do to make up for DeAndre Hopkins. You don't trade one of your best players ever in his prime, period. A guy who's on a Hall of Fame trajectory. And if you do that, you don't do that. But if you do that, you better get something in return, which is exactly what didn't happen there. And then you've got Amari Cooper. Amari Cooper re-signs with the Cowboys for a reported 5-year, $100 million. Again, it's all kind of weird to be talking about the NFL and business as usual when life is completely not normal or usual. But here we are. Dallas is where Cooper is going to be for the foreseeable future, and that makes sense. They did give up a first rounder to get him back in 2018. The offense did get a nice shot of adrenaline when he arrived. You don't just let that guy walk. but Washington reportedly did make a run at him. Washington reportedly offered him more money than Dallas did, but he decided to stay in Dallas, which makes sense. Again, not surprising. And now the question becomes, how do the Cowboys deal with Dak in the coming years? One more thought about all these moves. One more thought about free agency in the NFL. It does come with a huge warning. And the caveat is twofold. Number one, a lot of times the contracts are not what they appear. Not what they appear to be when they're first announced, because ultimately the guaranteed money is not the same as when they're announced. At least not in terms of the value of the deal. So the contracts are not always what they appear. And the second part is, a lot of times, a lot of these big splashes do not work out. A lot of teams making these moves are the same ones that make the same splashes year in and year out, and they miss the postseason year in and year out. Now, that doesn't mean that you can't strengthen your team in free agency, because you certainly can. Like, it doesn't mean that Jack Conklin to the Browns is not a good deal for Cleveland, because it is. They need help on the offensive line. He's a good right tackle. Bill Callahan's a good offensive line coach. All right, that reminds me, I had the weirdest dream the other night. Weirdest dream. So imagine, and this isn't one of those, hey man, he's talking about his dreams. He must have nothing to talk about. No, I got lots to talk about. This is a really weird dream that's in line with what I'm talking about right now. So I've done this for 30 years. 30 years, and I do not have dreams about work like this. This is the damnedest dream. The other night, I'm dreaming, and it's real as hell, because I'm terrified. I'm scared. I am a third-string quarterback for an NFL team. Guess who I'm backing up? Well, obviously, I'm backing up the backup. This is a real dream I had. I am backing up none other than Johnny Manziel. I'm at home, and I'm at home just hanging out. Like, I got nothing. I'm pulling an NFL check, but I don't need to be with the team because I'm the third stringer, and they're never going to get to me. This is how my dream goes. I'm at home just hanging out, and I don't even think I'm watching the game. I don't even give a damn. I'm getting paid, and I'm a third stringer, and they will never get to me on the depth chart until Manziel gets knocked the hell out, and they're on the phone, and somebody from the team says to me, it's not even the Browns. It's like, it's probably an XFL team. I don't even know. They tell me the car's coming. Get ready, man. You're playing. And nobody knows that I've never played football on any level. And then it kind of mixed with that dream I have about colleges, where I was in college and it was finals and I didn't know where my finals were because I hadn't gotten to class all quarter. And how that ties in is I hadn't even looked at the playbook yet for this team that I'm playing quarterback for. I know nothing about the playbook. And on top of that, I'm me. All right? I'm me. You know, 5'9", buck 60, 50-something. I'm me. And I'm going to play in the NFL. And I've never played quarterback, and I have no idea what's in the playbook. And they're saying, you're playing in the second half. And I'm going up against not nameless, faceless guys, but like the likes of Jadeveon Clowney. And I'm in the car riding to the stadium, and I'm like, holy bunch of whining babies. And man, it's real. Like, I'm going to die. Like, they know, too. They're coming for me. And I'm like, what am I going to do? They don't know that I've never played football, and I don't know the playbook. And I'm going to play, and I'm QB3 under center. Thank God I woke up, man. I didn't actually get in the game. But it was one of those dreams. You know how dreams are real? Like, the ones that are really real, where you just sit there in bed for a couple minutes, like, damn. Damn, that was scary. Wow. A few times a year, you wake up and you're like, you are so relieved that that was a dream. That didn't really happen. That was one of those times. I'm like, yeah, man, that would not have gone well. Anyway, even Jack Conklin could not have saved me. As good a move as I like for the Browns, as that is, they need help on their offensive line. Baker, my man, that's your problem, not mine. I don't even think it was a Browns thing. It was just a Johnny Manziel thing. I was backing up Manziel as the third-string quarterback.
I'm Johnny Manziel.
So even as somebody who's hosted this show as long as I have, I don't have dreams like that. I never dreamt that I was going to take over for Derek Jeter. I never dreamt that I was going to get up above the rim and throw it down on Zion. But man, I came that close to going in for Johnny Manziel. What up, playa? What I'm saying is, I digress. What I'm saying is, it doesn't mean that it will or will not work out this time of year. Some of these free agent signings do work out. Like, it doesn't mean that Michael Brockers going to Baltimore is not a damn good move for Baltimore. It is. You combine him with the newly acquired Calais Campbell, that's a hell of a force up front. Cam Newton being given permission to seek a trade in Carolina is a big deal. That's a significant thing, but not surprising. So what I'm getting at is this as I go to break. Overall, a lot of moves that seem big right now might be pretty forgettable come fall and downright regrettable later on. But to me, not the Diggs to Buffalo move. Chris Mack. Chris, it's good to have you back. How are you?
I'm doing great. How you doing, Jim?
I'm doing great. In fact, I wanted to talk to you in March. I just did not think that I'd be talking to you under these circumstances. So kind of bring me up today, Chris. How are you and your family doing right now? How's everybody holding up?
We're doing great. You know, we're very, very fortunate. But just as you know, an odd time that we all live in, and feel deeply for my seniors and the guys that had one last go around, and just a little bit surreal when it comes to the end of our season and how quickly it played out.
You know, I'm certainly going to ask you about them and how that season played out. I do want to ask you one more thing about the family, Chris, because, you know, with school shutting down, a lot of us are dealing with this. Kids are at home. They've got to get online and do their classes. You tweeted yesterday, quote, 8 weeks of TikToking, hashtag girl dad. So it could be eight long weeks. How's that going so far?
It's going great so far, but 8 weeks is going to be a long time. But my girls, all they do is walk around the house constantly in dance movement motion. And so it's become a cultural thing for girls 13 to 16 years old, and I've got two of them in that age group, and that's all they do is TikTok.
I get it. All right, so if we were to go back to last week, you went down to Greensboro, North Carolina for the ACC tourney. You were supposed to play Syracuse in the quarterfinals. What was your mindset as you got ready for that game? In other words, were you at all concerned that the game might be affected by coronavirus, or were you just locked in on the game itself?
Just moved really, really quickly. A couple days prior to the game, not knowing who we were going to play, Carolina or Syracuse, it really didn't cross my mind. You know, at some point it became, well, maybe they're not going to have fans in the building, but certainly we're going to play the game. And then, you know, you play out a couple hours or a few hours later, and the whole tournament gets canceled. It just sort of seemed like things were heading in that direction. And although we try to do our best to, as coaches, staff, meet and prepare for what we thought was to come, you also had this nagging feeling that the tournament was going to be canceled. And it was like a domino effect. You know, once one conference tournament got canceled, and I believe the Big Ten was the first one that really the high major conferences sort of fell in line with not having it, you knew just it was going to be inevitable.
Louisville head coach Chris Mack is joining us. So then once that happens, I mean, that's obviously a very bitter pill to have to swallow, but you understand it. So how do you go about processing that and talking your players through that? What were those conversations like?
Well, by the time I actually was able to sit down with the team, they already knew. You know, it's one of those things where social media moves a heck of a lot faster than you can in person. And so by the time I got our players already gathered in a ballroom in a hotel, they pretty much knew that the tournament was canceled, and I mean the ACC tournament. So from that point on, I just told them, hey, we're in a wait-and-see mode. We're going to try to get back to campus as quickly as we can, which turned out to be the next day on Friday morning. But at the same time, you know, we still held out hope at around 1 o'clock or maybe 12:30 in the afternoon on Thursday that we were still going to be able to figure out how to play the NCAA tournament. And then obviously that didn't come to fruition just a few hours later. And much like how I had to announce the ACC tournament being canceled, the NCAA tournament being canceled was something our players found out before I had a chance to talk to them.
We're talking to Chris Mack. So what about that? I mean, to your point, the plan was for the NCAA tournament to continue without fans, and then you get word, as you point out, that that's being canceled as well. So when you get that news, where were you and what kind of emotions went through you at that point?
I was sitting down with my athletic director in my hotel room in Greensboro, and we were just going over different options and, you know, ways to get back. And the next thing you know, he's trying to update me on ACC tournament, and he was trying to update me on his call with the conference. And the next thing you know is we see it on television. You know, we see it on the bottom line of ESPN that the NCAA tournament has been canceled. So it was disappointing. You know, like I said, we almost felt like it was becoming inevitable at that point. And just a really, really tough feeling when it became reality.
We are talking to Chris Mack. I appreciate your thoughts on all those things. You know, there had been talk at one point of the NCAA maybe doing a Selection Sunday show, even though the tournament was not going to happen. That was something that you were in favor of. How come? Why did you like that idea?
Well, the first thing I'd tell you I was in favor of was postponing the tournament.
Okay.
And I said at the time that people that made that decision have a heck of a lot more information than I did. You know, whether it was about the virus, whether it was from health experts, whether it was inevitable. You know, and all the contracts and television and everything that goes into the tournament venues. But, you know, being able to postpone it, I thought made a lot more sense at the time. You know, you look at it 96 hours later and you say, they probably knew what we all know now. I do think until you have a team of your own, until you're sitting in an airport basically saying goodbye to the seniors as we all go our separate ways, usually you end the season. You have a team meeting. We really couldn't have that meeting. We weren't allowed to get back into our facility on campus. It was just really, really odd. There was really no closure. I felt like, you know, the NCAA tournament, the bracket reveal, Jim, does two things. Number one, it does celebrate, you know, the type of year that you had. You know, when you sit down for a Selection Sunday, and I've been a part of 22 of them, it's special. And I know this one was going to be different. I understand that. But I also think it would give an opportunity to sort of have closure to your team, to know that there was some type of achievement rather than just sort of, you know, hanging out in the wind, which is, you know, what I felt happened. And I get that there were 100-and-something games left to be played in conference tournaments, but like the ACC tournament or the ACC league did, our commissioner appointed Florida State as the conference champion based on winning the regular season. And so I thought you could have done that with all the tournaments that were remaining, but be that as it may, you know, it's a decision that they made. And, you know, no matter how this sort of played out or was going to play out or if this different decisions were made, there was going to be no tournament. And, you know, it's unlike anything I've ever really seen, you know, in my lifetime in sports.
And no doubt. Louisville head coach Chris Mack joining us. You know, not to be redundant, but I think this is really important. I mean, it's not just a journey that's taken place over the course of the season, and certainly it is that, but this goes back further. It goes back to when you first arrived at Louisville. As you wrote in a post on Thursday, Ryan McMahon, Dwayne Sutton, Stephen Enoch, they listened to you talk before you were originally introduced as the head coach, and they bought in from the outset. So how emotional and challenging has it been for you and them knowing that it ends like this in a really bizarre and weird way?
Just really bizarre and weird way. And I say to our team every year, especially to sort of spur on our seniors, that, you know, I'll have the I'll be lucky enough to coach more teams, but this is your last go around. You know, this is your final shot. How do you want to be remembered? And I constantly use that as a carrot to our team because that's how they're going to go out, remembering their senior year more than any other year that they play. And for me to be able to say that all year long, and then at the end of the year, that's how it ends in an airport in Louisville, I can't get over it for our seniors. And, again, I know that there are bigger things in the world that's happening right now that, you know, the rest of the entire world is dealing with, you know, the virus and the epidemic and trying to control it. But it doesn't make the pain of what our guys went through, how they bought in from the very beginning, how they were incredible leaders and guys that only cared about their teammates and winning. It's just a bittersweet deal to end like that.
No, I get that. That's why I'm trying to ask you about a couple of the guys so I make sure that we can reference them. Like, for instance, you went on to write about how Fresh Kimball FaceTimed you 10 months ago to let you know that he was coming to Louisville without ever visiting, and how Keith Otto graduated from Richmond and he came to Louisville as a walk-on. What have the two of them meant to you in the program?
They've meant a whole lot. You know, Keith didn't have to come to Louisville. I mean, he could have just sort of gone to a Division II place and played a lot more and had an opportunity to get on the floor and earn minutes. He knew coming to Louisville that he was going to be nothing more than a bench player. He just wanted to be on a winning team at a high major level. He wanted to learn from a different coaching staff after being with Chris Mooney, a great coach at Richmond. And then Fresh Kimball, as I said before, you know, in the post, was a guy that felt so comfortable in the relationship with me and our coaching staff that he didn't have to come on campus and take a visit in order to say, that's where I want to be. He FaceTimed me, said, Coach, I'm coming to Louisville. Don't even worry about the visit. I can't wait to get there. And so one of the big reasons why he came to Louisville was to play in the NCAA tournament. And so it gives me a little bit of solace that no matter where he would have gone, he'd have been, you know, in the same circumstance. But at the same time, it's still a tough pill to swallow for him ending his career that way.
Louisville head coach Chris Mack helping me close the show. Now, as you point out, the team may not have been perfect, but it was a really good team. You were number one in the country earlier this season. You were primed for a deep run. So in time, when people look back on this team, Team 106, what should they remember about this group?
I just think that we were a group that played really hard and played well together. You know, I think that, we were 2 minutes away. We were on Virginia's floor to tie for the ACC regular season championship. And, that's what our goal was. And you know, we couldn't finish it off. And so I think our guys were extremely hungry to play out the rest of the year. But, as I said in the post that I talked about before, Jim, I give a ton of credit to those seniors, the guys that didn't have the opportunity to play on. I give them a ton of credit for really establishing a culture with the new coaching staff and hopefully setting the tone for the future.
So, Chris, before I let you go, I had Pat Kelsey on the show on Friday, and we talked about the fact that you and he got into a fight back in the day when you hung on the rim in his backyard. Now, the way he tells it, he said he saw you playing outside, you throw one down, you pull yourself up on it, and you're hanging on it. He said he came running out and wanted to get nose to nose with you, but it turned out to be nose to belly button because he was so short. How do you remember what went down?
Well, you know, as stories get older and older, Jim, they start to get embellished. The dunking part was correct. The hanging on the rim was correct. Pulling myself up was a total made-up fabrication by Kels. He did run out. He did try to provoke me and get in the fight, but I remained very even-keeled. I was a senior. Pat was an eighth grader at the time, and you know, I didn't want to get in trouble for beating up some little eighth grade punk as he was during the whole ordeal. It really scarred me. I tried to stay away from that side of town from there on out. If people were going to raise their kids in that way, I didn't want to have anything to do with them.
Oh, man, that is so good. That is so, so good. What else do you remember? What were those runs like in that backyard?
They were legendary. Pat's not lying. You know, anybody and everybody that played basketball at that time found their way to the Kelsey house. And, for him to have a glass backboard back in the day, I mean, now it's sort of commonplace as you drive through neighborhoods, but for him to have a full-size regulation NBA glass backboard was something special.
No doubt. The head basketball coach at Louisville, a second season there, and it is disappointing, obviously, for everybody to have it end like this, but everybody does understand. They were 24-7, 15-5, and number 13 in the coaches' poll. Chris, I appreciate it. Good luck with everything. All the best. And, yes, it could be a long 8 weeks of TikToking, but it could be so much worse.
Sounds good, Jim. Thanks for having me.
Good night now!